طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We begin this morning with a report by MSNBC's Mehdi Hassan speaking with journalist Anthony Lowenstein, who has written a book documenting how Israel uses Gaza as a testing ground for their massive armaments industry.
Last week, Israel bombed the occupied Gaza Strip, and Palestinian militants in Gaza responded with rocket fire into Israel. The Israeli military said their bombing was a response to rocket fire the previous week by the group Islamic Jihad. Israel's airstrikes on the densely packed strip killed 33 Palestinians, including three children, while two people in Israel were killed by rocket fire in response, according to the UN. Though a ceasefire agreement was reached after 5 days of violence, there's no indication of any end in sight for the conflict in Gaza. Because the thing is, sadly, frustratingly, this is not a new story. As UN records show, there was the 2021 Gaza conflict that killed 261 Palestinians and 13 Israelis. The 2018 Gaza March of Return that claimed 214 Palestinian lives and one Israeli soldier. The 2014 Gaza War, dubbed by Israel as Operation Protective Edge, that killed 2,251 Palestinians and 73 Israelis. The 2012 Gaza War, known as Operation Pillar of Defense, that killed 168 Palestinians and 4 Israelis. And the devastating 2009 Gaza War, or Operation Cast Lead, that left 1,385 Palestinians and 4 Israelis dead. You get the drift here. It's a seemingly never-ending chain of violence and chaos in which Palestinians bear the brunt of the casualties. Israel, of course, tries to frame it all as a war against terrorism, while Palestinians say it's really about racism and colonialism and occupation. But what if it's about something else as well? Good old-fashioned capitalism. That's what journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein provocatively argues in his new book, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. See, Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories has been going on since 1967, and its clash with the Arabs since 1948. But after 9/11, the conflict in the region took a new turn as Israel positioned itself as a key ally in the global war on terror. And as Lowenstein writes of the Israeli strategy, the message was unambiguous. We have been fighting a war on terror since our birth. We'll show you how it's done. And that they did, because as Lowenstein writes, Israel has developed a world-class weapons industry with equipment conveniently tested on occupied Palestinians, then marketed as battle-tested, cashing in on the IDF brand has successfully led to Israeli security companies being some of the most successful in the world. The Palestine Laboratory is a signature Israeli selling point. The Palestine Laboratory, he calls it. Lowenstein even details an Israeli defense company using actual footage of their drones striking in Gaza in their promotional video. A strike that may have, as global arms trade expert Andrew Feinstein told him, turned out to have killed civilians, including kids. But hey, it's a strategy that has bolstered the Israeli economy, as Israel's defense industry is now one of its leading export businesses. In 2021 alone, the Israeli Defense Ministry reported arms sales were the highest on record, totaling $11.3 billion, a $3 billion jump from the year prior. And Israel sat on a list of the world's top 10 biggest exporters of major weapons between 2018 and 2022. Here's the thing. The benefits to Israel of a never-ending war on Gaza are actually twofold. Not only does the Strip serve as a testing ground and key selling point for Israeli weaponry, but the nations that purchase these weapons are then more likely to turn a blind eye to any abuses committed by Israel. As Lowenstein writes, Israel has sold so much defense equipment to so many nations that it hopes to insulate itself from any political backlash to its endless occupation. As long as the world's richest countries keep buying its weapons, Israel is unlikely to face any real political consequences for its illegal occupation of Palestinian territories. And there's certainly no financial incentive for Israel to end its almost year-in, year-out violence against the people of Gaza, because quite simply and quite clearly, it would be bad for business. Joining me now is Anthony Lowenstein, author of The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. Anthony, thanks for joining me. How much does the financial incentive, the arms industry, the testing of weapons drive Israel's occupation and its war in Gaza in particular, do you think? Where does it rank alongside political ideology, religious fanaticism, terrorism? How big a factor is it?
I don't think Israel fights its wars solely for that reason. I don't think Israel, for example, launches attacks on Gaza or the West Bank simply to battle test weapons. However, as you rightly say, it's kind of an insurance policy. You know, Israel's had the longest occupation in modern times, 56 years and counting. And for so much of that history, although it started before 1967, there have been a slew of weapons technologies, everything from spyware, smart walls, facial recognition, biometric tools, and they're often tested in Palestine, not just in Gaza, but also the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And what you then find is that, as I discovered in the research in my book, roughly 130 countries, so the vast majority of the countries in the world, democracies and dictatorships, are buying some form of that technology, those tools, because they themselves want to repress their own minorities, their own journalists, dissidents, human rights workers, whatever it may be. So I don't think, as I said, Israel launches wars solely for that reason, but it's a key factor in how Israel sees itself around the world.
And just to be clear, picking up on something you just said a moment ago, Israel does brag about being the only democracy in the Middle East, but it does have no issue selling its high-tech weapons and its surveillance technology to other autocracies, including in the Middle East, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the whole really unspoken issues around the so-called Abraham Accords, this Trump deal from a few years ago, was the UAE, Bahrain and others that were friends with Israel. Now, this wasn't about democracy or friendship. It was an arms deal, essentially, that those countries were desperate for Israeli repressive tech, spyware, etc., and they're now using that technology against their own citizens. And Israel doesn't care about that. I mean, Israel is now the 10th biggest arms exporter in the world. And many of those countries that are buying that technology are dictatorships. And one of the things I talk about in the book is this is not just about arms dealing. It's also about ethno-nationalism, that Israel wants to promote itself as the ideal way to sell itself in the world. So in other words, other states like Hungary or India, both nations that are very close to Israel, view itself as ideologically aligned, as apartheid South Africa did with Israel back in the day. So I don't think, for example, India under Modi is repressing Muslims in Kashmir because of Israel. But Indian officials have openly said they admire what Israel's doing in the West Bank. They want to copy what Israel's doing in the West Bank, namely, in their case, bringing many more Hindus into Muslim-controlled Kashmir. So there's also an ideological element to this war on terror as well.
So, Anthony, the impact of Israel's Palestine laboratory, quote-unquote, reaches the United States as well. In your book, you write, the U.S.-Mexico border has become a major site of Israeli security and surveillance companies, and their work in Palestine is used as a recruitment tool, which kind of surprised me and might surprise a lot of our viewers. What are the implications of that?
Well, huge, because on the U.S.-Mexico border, one of the key surveillance tools and towers that not just Trump, but Biden and many others, so Democrat and Republican, are using is an Israeli company called Elbit, which is Israel's biggest defense company. And those surveillance towers are dotted across the border. And the reason why a company like Elbit gets that contract is because it's been battle tested in Palestine. They're often used across the West Bank and across the border with Gaza to so-called secure those areas. So this is a good example, in fact, a grim example of how the Palestine laboratory is exported. The occupation in Israel and Palestine doesn't remain there. It's an exportable, almost sort of very convenient pack that can be sent around the world. And again, the U.S.-Mexico border doesn't solely need Israeli technology, but it's very key to what America is doing, which had been, in fact, has been deepened by Biden after the Trump years.
One last question, Anthony. Military analysts have been pointing out, as Al Jazeera reported back in January, that the Kremlin's military strategies and tactics used in Ukraine were first tried and tested in Chechnya in the 1990s. Is there a trend here? How much are militaries around the world looking at existing territorial conflicts as laboratories to develop and test their military capabilities? it's a pretty cynical, some might say depraved, way of operating.
It is. But the US, of course, did that in depth in Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11, where a lot of the weapons that they were using then ended up being sold around the world. And the US is still the world's biggest arms dealer by far. And in fact, the current war in Ukraine has also become a testing ground for a range of weapons. But I think what's important to note is that what you see in Palestine, as I said, what you see in Ukraine, what you saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, don't stay there. The repression always comes home, meaning the US, other Western countries. So if viewers might believe that somehow what's happening is only happening over there, it always comes home. And when you have a reliable, repressed population in Palestine, like Israel does, it's an endless supply of battle-tested weapons. And this, to me, is the most disturbing thing, that, as you said in your introduction, Mehdi, unless the global community decides that spyware, smart walls is not the way to do business, then the occupation will not end. And without economic sanctions and other ways, this situation will continue indefinitely.
Anthony Lowenstein, we will have to leave it there. The new book is The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. Thank you.
Moving on. Today's feature presentation is a conversation with journalist Ali Abu Nima in an Electronic Intifada podcast moderated by Nora Barons Friedman and Asa Winstanley.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barons Friedman.
And I'm Asa Winstanley. Today we'll be talking about the Electronic Intifada's top stories of 2022. And we're delighted to be joined again by Executive Director Ali Abu Nima, not only to take a look back at the past year in Palestine and Palestine-related news, but also to discuss the state of journalism, Western complicity in Israel's apartheid regime, and how activism in support of Palestinian rights continue to shape the narrative.
Ali, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you. It's always my top goal is to be invited on the Electronic Intifada podcast to make the cut.
Good. You came in just under the wire. Let's start by talking about the unmitigated violence that Israel has inflicted on Palestinians over the last 12 months. Around 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces and settlers so far this year, or have died from injuries sustained in previous years. And just some statistics from our recent reporting, at least 34 Palestinian children have been killed by Israeli forces or settlers in the West Bank so far this year. Additionally, 17 Palestinian children were killed during Israel's three-day offensive in the Gaza Strip in August. At least 9 of them were killed in Israeli strikes, and others were killed by rockets fired by armed groups in Gaza or in ambiguous circumstances. We also saw the execution of Palestinian journalists, most notoriously the murder of Palestinian-American Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akleh in May. And the U.S. State Department continues to dismiss and ignore forensic evidence that an Israeli sniper intentionally murdered her. Ali, we saw the killing or injuring of Palestinians nearly every day this year, including during the August attacks on Gaza, and the political fueling of this violence by Israel's fascist government officials. Can you talk about Israel's sweeping policies of violence in 2022 and what stands out to you when we look back over this year?
It seems like it's almost a daily ritual to wake up and see the names and faces of the Palestinians who've been killed overnight, as it is overnight for us sitting, as I am in the U.S., in towns, villages, refugee camps, cities across Palestine. And this year, already, the year's not over, but Israel killed more Palestinians in the West Bank this year since at least 2005. That's when OCHA, the UN agency, UN humanitarian agency, started keeping these statistics. And that includes more than 50 children, as you noted, Nora. This violence is escalating because it's a direct consequence of Israel's continued theft and expansion on Palestinian land. settler colonialism is an inherently violent process. And so there's no such thing as Israeli settlements, Israeli colonization, Israeli dominance of the Palestinians without this brutal violence. And at the same time that the violence has been escalating, it seems that Western governments and Arab governments, who are generally client regimes of the West, are also escalating their rewards for Israel. So there is not there are individual Israelis who perpetrate these killings, or for the Israeli state and its leaders, they can carry on with killing as usual.
You know, there's been a lot of focus over the last month or so about the new Israeli government officials. And, you know, a lot of hand-wringing, oh, this is the, you know, the most extreme government, you know, we've ever seen. But as you've been saying, you know, this is just a continuation. I think last year you said something like it's a different executioner, but the same axe. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of the you know, of Itamar Ben-Gvir and the formation of this new Israeli government?
Right. As we're speaking, Nora, Benjamin Netanyahu is putting the finishing touches, so to speak, to his new coalition. And as I think viewers and listeners will know, it's going to include Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, the two leaders of this party called Jewish Power or Jewish Strength, depending on how you translate it. And who are these people? Well, Itamar Ben-Gvir is notorious as a inciter of violence against Palestinians. He's a settler. He's often in Hebron, where some of the most violent and extreme settlers are. And I think for me, the most indelible image of Itamar Ben-Gvir is from when he was younger. There's Israeli television footage of him in 1994, or 1995, excuse me, dressed up for Purim as Baruch Goldstein. Who is Baruch Goldstein? He is the American Jewish settler from Brooklyn who, on February 25th of 1994, on the third Friday of Ramadan, went into the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron and machine gunned to death 29 Palestinian men and boys as they were praying. And a year later, on Purim, Baruch Goldstein dressed up, Itamar Ben-Gvir, dressed up as Baruch Goldstein, this mass killer, and said on Israeli national television, he's my hero. Now, if you think that was just some kind of youthful foolishness on behalf of Ben-Gvir, that's not at all the case. As recently as 2019, he bragged about keeping a portrait of Baruch Goldstein, the mass murderer, on his living room wall. And he continues to directly incite violence against Palestinians. As recently as October, he showed up in occupied East Jerusalem as settlers were attacking Palestinians, and Palestinians in their neighborhoods and refugee camps were, you know, exercising their right to protest, to fight back. Ben-Gvir showed up brandishing a pistol and urging settlers, if Palestinians throw stones, shoot them. Just, you know, shoot them in the street, like, you know, the same tactics of British colonialists in South Africa or India or French colonialists in Algeria. But this is 2022. And Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who is no different, I mean, these are cut from the same cloth, are slated for top so-called national security posts in Netanyahu's government. So, of course, this is causing a lot of hand-wringing, particularly among sort of liberal Zionist Israel lobby groups in Britain and in the United States and other countries, because, you know, they're saying, oh, Ben-Gvir is a step too far. Israel's lovely, precious democracy is being threatened by, you know, ogres like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. But the reality is the violence and the hatred and the incitement of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich has always been Israeli government policy and practice. I mean, the people who carried out the massacres in Deir Yassin and Tantura in 1948 were not any different from Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. The difference now is that Israel has discovered that it will enjoy unconditional support no matter what it does. I'm kind of reminded of when Donald Trump famously said, you know, I could shoot someone dead in the middle of Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't affect my popularity. And he was right for at least a very long time. And Israel is really, it's the Donald Trump of nations in that sense. Israel can do whatever it wants to Palestinians. And U.S. politicians, particularly top Democrats, of course, Republicans, but top Democrats and British politicians, whether it's Keir Starmer, who leads the Labour Party, I'm sure we'll talk about that, European Union leaders, whoever it is, the leaders of the United Arab Emirates. Ben-Gvir was warmly welcomed at the United Arab Emirates Embassy in Tel Aviv recently. There are photos of the ambassador there warmly greeting him. So Israel's discovered it can do what it wants, and the unconditional support from governments will continue. So why disguise it? Why not put somebody who has a loving portrait of Baruch Goldstein on his living room wall in charge of national security? From Israel's perspective, there's no downside.
Right. Let's rewind a little bit more and talk about the 3 days in August when Israel attacked Gaza. You know, this comes on the heels of May of 2021, when Israel launched its previous attack on Gaza. Can you talk a little bit about what happened this past August and the significance of how it ended so quickly?
What happened was that the so-called centrist moderate government of Yair Lapid, the outgoing government, launched a surprise attack on Gaza to assassinate a senior official of Islamic Jihad, one of the Palestinian resistance groups in his home, shattering the ceasefire that had prevailed since May of 2021, Israel's last spasm of, you know, its last brutal orgy of violence in Gaza. This violence is, of course, ongoing. We're talking about the sort of the big conflagrations that start to draw attention from the rest of the world. And, you know, it's such a typical pattern. Israel always breaks these ceasefires, and then when Palestinians respond in any way, that then becomes the justification by Israel's supporters for Israel to attack Palestinians back. I think it ended quick. It was 3 days of horror in Gaza, you know, not to underestimate it. And dozens of people were killed, as you noted, 17 children, Nora. But the Palestinian groups weren't looking for that fight with Israel. They didn't start it, and they weren't trying to escalate it. At the time, Israel attacked an Islamic Jihad leader, and in coordination with the other resistance groups, Islamic Jihad launched rocket fire towards Israel in response to the Israeli attack. But there was a joint decision by the resistance groups. They have what they call the Joint Operation Room. Not for the other major groups, particularly Hamas, the largest, resistance faction not to enter the fight. In other words, they were not seeking escalation. The message they were sending is, we're ready to escalate if we have to, because we will defend Palestinians in Gaza, but we're not looking for it. And so I think it was the cooler heads of the Palestinian resistance leaders that managed to stop this orgy of Israeli violence from becoming even worse, as it was in May 2021 or 2014 or 2008 or so many of the countless times Israel has done this. But I think what it was, you know, the Israelis have this term called mowing the lawn, which is just a psychopathic term. You can imagine the grass gets too long, so you take out the lawnmower and cut the grass every week or 2 weeks or whatever it is. What they mean by mowing the lawn is that if Palestinians in Gaza get the idea that they can resist or stand up to Israel, then you have to go in and do a massacre in order to keep them down again. That's what Israel means by mowing the lawn. So every now and then Israel wants to do these mowing the lawn massacres in Gaza just to make sure that that message from their perspective gets through.
Yeah, it's it's a depressingly frequent story, you know.
Yeah,
Israeli attacks on Gaza that we have to continue to return to time and time and again. And you know, every time it happens, I feel like in the West, in Britain, and I don't know if this is your experience in the US, but I feel like activists, usually the younger generation of activists, we all have this kind of moment where we think, oh, it's so clear now, surely things are going to change, there's going to be, you know, a sort of sea change, and it never quite happens. Although, you know, I think things have changed over time, and you know, you were talking earlier about Itamar Ben-Gvir and the whole new government coming in now inside Israel. And I find it really interesting because for me, I do think it's an interesting moment because for many years, I mean, for decades, really, it was always put out by liberal Zionist propagandists, really, this idea that, you know, oh, these are the extremists, the Kahanists, you know, the followers of Rabbi Meir Kahana, as Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are, who was this really kind of psychopathic settler, Jewish-American settler from Brooklyn, who was a real extremist. And I think that the kind of liberal Zionist propaganda that was put out to me was one of the things about it was there would be, from time to time, Israel would ban one of the right. Arab Palestinian Arab parties inside the Knesset. You know, there were several there's been attempts to ban them. I think that at one point there was a Palestinian Arab party that was banned, and then they would sort of cover that by saying, "Ah, oh, well, we're going to ban," like the Koch party, which was one of the Kahanist parties, was banned at the same time as one of them, and so they were trying to say, "Oh, look, there's extremists on both sides, and we're sort of right. banning them." But now, you know, they're not only in Knesset, but they're leading the government. They have these leading positions in the government. And, you know, it's interesting because, like you said, they're no different in many ways from the people who carried out the, you know, the Deir Yassin massacre and the Tantura massacre. You know, if you look in the history, Deir Yassin massacre, yes, it was carried out by the Egun and the Lichai, the revisionist Zionists, the right-wing Zionists who were the forerunners of the Likud party. But it was also supported, like there was, it was supported by the so-called, you know, I guess we could say they were liberal Zionists who would have called themselves socialists. You know, the Haganah, which was the mainstream of the Zionist movement in Palestine at the time, provided artillery support for the Deir Yassin massacre. And so it's, you know, these kind of political differences within Israel are really played up, I think, by pro-Israel propagandists, when in actual fact and in actual reality, they really all work together.
You know, the one thing I want to disagree with you on, Asa, not disagree, but maybe develop. You said that after these Israeli massacres in Gaza, we think things are, you know, going to change, but then they don't. I think that has to be qualified. There is a sea change.
Right.
But you have to be specific about what you're talking about. So, yes, yeah. The governments, whether it's the US government or the EU or the Arab regimes, their client regimes who are armed by the US and the EU, they don't change. They continue to throw themselves at Israel's feet. But there is a sea change in public opinion. And I think you can see that, for example, in the World Cup. The World Cup is really a showcase of that. And I don't know if we can add in that viral clip of the England fans.
Okay. First question. Wait a minute. First question. Is it coming home?
It's coming home. It's coming home.
But the clip is an Israeli TV channel interviewing these four English, I guess you'd call them lads, following. I think they're more lads than chaps.
Yeah,
you can correct me. Following England beating Senegal. I'm impressed at myself for knowing that it was Senegal. And so the Israeli reporter, you know, is just very excited about this. And, oh, you know, is it coming home? In other words, England bringing the trophy home. And then he says, you know, I guess roll the clip. But the fact that this, I think it was so unexpected, you know, there has been incredible displays of solidarity from players. You know, the Moroccan team, when they won their famous victory against Spain, brought out the Palestinian flag. And there have been so many examples of that. And there's been no popular pushback to that. On the contrary, people seem to be loving it all over the world. And
yeah,
to me, that's a symbol. I mean, the world...
That has changed. That has changed.
And Asa, maybe at some point you want to talk about how in the UK you have these Palestine action activists who have been going around literally smashing up Israeli arms factories in the UK. And I don't know now how many have been charged with criminal damage and other crimes.
I can't
crimes.
Keep count, honestly.
And they keep every single time so far, knock on wood, getting acquitted by judges, by juries in the UK, who are accepting the argument that, yes, under normal circumstances, going and smashing windows and equipment in, you know, a quiet town in Britain would be a crime, but they're accepting the argument that these acts are justified because they aim to stop a bigger crime, which is Israel's violations of the rights of the Palestinians. So that's, to me, again, a sign of the sea change. And there's similar things in the US as well that we see going on. So I think, I think that is something to celebrate. It's, of course, not yet translating into the kind of change we want to see in terms of what governments are doing, but Israel has completely lost the battle for hearts and minds, and there's no going back on that.
Yeah. Let's talk about the execution of Shirin Abu Akleh and how that reverberated around the world, not just in, you know, Palestine related activism circles or across Palestine itself, but really around the world because of the just naked, brutal impunity that Israel has enjoyed, you know, for the last 75 years, but also specifically around Shirin's assassination. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, when when it was talked about, you know, in the mainstream press, in Western media, what was still left out of the discussion was what the Israeli army was doing in Jenin in the first place. That was never interrogated. It was never debated or analyzed or given any context whatsoever. It was just like a natural thing that the Israeli occupation army was in Jenin at the time. Ali, can you talk a little bit about Shirin Abu Akleh and you know, the ongoing fight to you know, to bring justice for her, for her family, and for, you know, countless other Palestinian journalists?
Yeah, I think, you know, that morning, I was actually in Amman in Jordan on the morning of May 11th when Shirin Abu Akleh was killed. And had I been in the US, I would have been asleep. But I was up early, and this was all unfolding basically live on social media. And later, you know, at the beginning, some of the clips were circulating, just the utter horror, because people knew Shirin Abu Akleh. She'd been a fixture on Al Jazeera screens for 25 years. She was 50, 51 years old. And so for half her life, she had been in that role, and she was just trusted and loved by Palestinians and a fixture. And one of the real universally known and respected figures. She was a great journalist, and she was someone who, you know, people would say she was very courageous in hindsight, but you just took it for granted that Shirin was always going to be there and doing her job. And that's what she was doing that morning in Jenin when she was gunned down in cold blood, executed live on television, as she was wearing a helmet and a vest, clearly marked press. And it was clearly a marksman who was able to shoot her in the head despite her protective gear. And what can you say? I think the message that was sent, whether intentionally or not by Israel, and I think there's reasonable grounds to believe intentionally, is that, look, even Shirin Abu Akleh is not safe. We can do what we want to her. So don't think any of you are safe. And watch us do this with complete impunity. And that's what has happened up to this point. Because, of course, the Israeli spin machine immediately went into gear. Naftali Bennett, the prime minister at the time, immediately put out videos on Twitter, just outright lying, fake videos claiming that Palestinian gunmen had killed Shirin Abu Akleh. What I think, if there's any sort of comfort in what happened, was how quickly Israel's lies unraveled. And journalist after journalist and human rights group after human rights group quickly went in, and they were able to debunk the Israeli government's lies. B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, did an incredible thread on Twitter immediately showing how the videos that Bennett had posted could not have been the people who killed Shirin Abu Akleh. Then you had Al-Haq, which did a field investigation immediately afterwards. And then you had, I think it's now nine independent investigations. And that included investigations from human rights groups, but also CNN, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and others, that all reached the same conclusion. It couldn't have been done by Palestinians. It almost certainly was done by Israel. And that changed the narrative. It forced Israel, first of all, it forced the Biden administration to admit, yeah, Israel probably did it. But, you know, we don't think they did it deliberately. I mean, the U.S., of course, tried to help Israel cover it up, but they weren't able to. And Israel wasn't able to. They eventually had to come out in September and admit, yeah, we did it, but it wasn't a criminal, you know, it wasn't a criminal act. Lina Abu Akleh, Shireen Abu Akleh's niece, and the rest of the family have waged a determined campaign in the name of Shireen and in the name of all Palestinians who are subjected to this horror, insisting that there be accountability and justice, and demanding that the U.S. launch its own investigation into the killing and that there be criminal accountability. And just as of the last few days, Al Jazeera, with the support of the family, actually filed a criminal complaint at the International Criminal Court. We'll have to see if that goes anywhere, given the court's constant foot dragging on the question of Palestine. But also I want to mention in this context that the year started, 2022, started with the murder of another Palestinian American, because, of course, everyone knows, I think, at this point that Shireen Abu Akleh is Palestinian American, which is why there is this particular demand on the United States government to insist on accountability. But at the beginning of the year, on January 12th, Omar Asad, a Palestinian American great grandfather, the father of seven and grandfather of 17, I think it was, and great grandfather of three, 78 years old, had retired from 40 years of, you know, running small grocery stores in and around Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and the Chicago area. After 40 years, he moved back to his village of Jeljilia. He and his wife, Nazmiya, built a house in order to enjoy their retirement years around friends and family. And on that night of January 12th, he was on his way home from driving home across his village from a relative's house where they'd been playing cards and drinking tea and watching TV, just having a good time. And he was stopped by Israeli soldiers, forced out of the car, shackled, blindfolded, frog marched to a construction site where other Palestinians were being blindfolded and detained, horribly abused, and then just left dead in the street. And the autopsy found that it was the shock and the stress. He'd had quadruple bypass surgery a few years earlier. This was an elderly man, not in good health, who had not done anything to anyone. And he was just brutalized and left dead. And the U.S. government, his family, I wrote about this, his family have also demanded that the U.S. Justice Department investigate, and they have done nothing. They haven't even answered the requests. But recently, we've seen some action from the U.S. government where the specific unit whose soldiers killed Omar Asad is now being sort of tentatively investigated by the U.S. government under the so-called Leahy Law. It's far from enough. It's far from adequate. But to the extent that the U.S. is being forced to pay attention to these horrible crimes, it's because of the pressure from the families. It's because of the pressure from activists. It's because of the pressure from members of Congress, including 24 senators who wrote demanding a U.S. investigation and accountability for Shireen Abu Akleh's killing. And similarly, lawmakers have made demands related to Omar Asad. And that in turn is because of the grassroots pressure. Those senators aren't just waking up one morning and saying, I want to do this. So again, those are the signs. Those are the things we can celebrate. No, it's not enough. No, there hasn't been justice for Shireen or for Omar Asad. But justice comes from the grassroots. It doesn't come from people sitting in offices on high meeting it out. And so that, but of course, just to wrap up this thought, we're talking about two Palestinians here who happen to be US citizens. And so there is slightly more attention. But remember, the vast majority, in fact, all Palestinians killed this year and any other year, this is done with impunity. There are no investigations. There's no justice. Where is the International Criminal Court? Why has it been sitting on the Palestine situation, even though they opened a formal investigation? Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor, has done absolutely nothing. He hasn't even mentioned Palestine until the last couple of days. For the first time, he mentioned Palestine and said he hopes to visit in 2023. Absolutely pathetic.
Yeah, I think one of the defining images of the year from Palestine for me was, you know, that video footage of Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral being attacked by Israeli troops. I mean, it just said so much, you know, that even in death, the Israeli occupation soldiers just won't leave Palestinians alone, you know, that there was this, you know, for all the tears and for the tragedy of Shireen's death, in a way, there was a beauty in the moment of Palestinians coming together to celebrate her life, you know. And, you know, Shireen was of Christian background as well. So she was coming from a church and Palestinian Christians and Muslims all together celebrating her life. But even that moment was brutally attacked by these Israeli occupation thugs. And it was, to me, it just said so much. And it just showed for a global audience, really, Israel's crimes for so many people.
Yeah.
It really did. And, you know, those images were so shocking to people. I mean, people looked at that around the world and said, you killed her. Why do you need to attack her funeral? And that sort of heart-stopping moment where it looked like her coffin was about to fall from the shoulders of the pallbearers as they were being brutally beaten and clubbed by these Israeli thugs in uniforms, and they managed, I don't know how they managed to keep her up,
keep the
coffin up and prevent just what would have been just an utter horrifying, already on top of a horrifying situation, an even more horrifying situation. But there is a logic to why Israel attacked the funeral. People, because of course afterwards, when these images went around the world, Israel tried to spin it and say, oh, well, yes, we'll look into this and we'll look into why did the officers behave like this? Again, trying to pass the buck down the chain of command as if this was just a local misbehavior by the officers in the street. It wasn't. There were orders from the top to prevent the funeral from becoming a mass gathering of Palestinians in Jerusalem. Israel had tried to impose conditions on the family that because people wanted to carry Shireen's casket on their shoulders through the streets of Jerusalem. And Israel tried to insist it has to be transferred by a car in order to prevent this from becoming a massive march. And all over Jerusalem, they were beating Palestinians, grabbing flags, trying to prevent Palestinians from holding or showing Palestinian flags. And it failed. When you saw the aerial images of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in the streets of Jerusalem, and Israel tried and failed to stop that, it was also a sign of how tenuous Israel's grip on Jerusalem is. Because remember, Israel's propaganda is, this is our city, it's our capital, no one can challenge us, we control it, we're the legitimate authority, and the Palestinians have to do what we say. And in death, Shireen showed that, no, the people of Jerusalem, the Palestinian people of Jerusalem, are in control of the city. And Israel really has a very tenuous grip on it. That, I think, too, was a very revealing moment.
You have been listening to Ali Abonema in conversation with Nora Barrows Friedman and Asa Winstanley of the Electronic Intifada. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the Internet. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org. That's all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. And then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. It's all there. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.